Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a Mideast peace group expresses its great concern about recent violence. An analyst speaks with us about the muddying of the fight against ISIL.
To me, it is a frightening scenario of an accidental war taking off.
Details of the Democratic presidential candidate's first debate. And we hear about a new documentary on Nobel Peace Prize-winning Malala Yousafzai. It's right here on The Voice of America. Americans for Peace Now is alarmed at the rapidly spiraling violence in East Jerusalem and the West Bank and blames the failure of peace talks as a direct reason for the violence. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Peace Now's Ori Nir about what is needed to defuse the tensions. Mohammed, he joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
The latest Israeli public opinion poll indicates that most Israelis realize that the status quo cannot be maintained and the situation will deteriorate further unless there is some hope for a peaceful settlement. However, more than 70% of the Israelis think their prime minister is too lenient with the Palestinians. How do you explain that?
Well, that looks initially like a contradiction. But according to Ori Nir, it is a reflection of the highly charged emotions stemming from the violence.
You know, when people see blood, they tend to become much more hawkish in their political views, and what they want is retribution, and they want security, and of course Israelis deserve security and so on. What people want more than anything is leadership. They want to feel that there is a leader there who knows what he's doing, who has an agenda, who has a plan. And I think that if someone like Netanyahu, who Israelis overall do trust, if he comes and says, okay, here's my plan. Yes, I'm going to take very severe measures against terrorists. Yes, I'm going to be, you know, strong to quell violence. But I'm also going to supplement that with some diplomatic measures. I think they'll support it. I think they'll go for it.
Ori Nir said that both the Israeli and Palestinian leaders have to act responsibly to stop the violence and save lives.
Well, we all know that the two sides cannot settle their conflict alone. The U.S. tried with no success. And then who will pick up the ball and run with it, Mohammed?
Well, France promised initially to submit a draft resolution to the U.N. Security Council calling for a resumption of peace talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis with what was termed as clear terms of reference and a definite timetable to reach a peace treaty between the two sides. But according to Ori Nir, France cannot do it alone.
Not alone, but I think that one of the things that the United States could do and probably should do is to take note of its success in leveraging the international community and its relationships with Europe in favor of an agreement with Iran. To look at that and to try to perhaps emulate this kind of formula in trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A larger, more robust role for the international community, I think, could be a good thing here.
Ori Nir added that if Israel is to remain a democratic Jewish state for years to come, things have to change because the Palestinian-Israeli conflict cannot be managed with continued Israeli control over millions of Palestinians.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for covering this story.
Thank you, sir.
People on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have been getting more vocal on social media as the violence in the region escalates. Michael Lippin joins me now for more on that. Michael, how are people making their case?
Hi, Susan. Well, on Twitter, you'll notice that many people are using hashtags that are mirror images of each other, and I'll give you some examples of that. Palestinians and their supporters are using hashtags like Palestine under attack and Palestinian Lives Matter. The Topsy Analytics website shows that Palestine under attack has been used about 900 times in the past 24 hours, while Palestinian Lives Matter was used just over 100 times in the same period. And now for the mirror images. On the other side, you have Israelis and their supporters using hashtag Israel under attack and hashtag Israeli Lives Matter. Topsy shows that Israel under attack has been used 1,400 times in the last day, while Israeli Lives Matter has been used about 600 times.
What other Twitter hashtags have you seen relating to the current wave of violence?
Well, I've seen quite a few others that are being used by supporters of the Palestinians. Hashtags like Israel kills the kids, Palestine resists, and Intifada al-Aqsa. Now, many of those hashtags are being used in tweets that accuse Israeli security forces of shooting and killing Palestinian youths in cold blood. Some of those tweets also include images purporting to show those killings. Now, from a journalistic standpoint, those images and accusations lack context and are difficult to verify. We know that some of the Palestinian youths killed in recent days were shot while carrying out stabbings against Israelis, while others were throwing rocks and firebombs at Israeli security forces. Now, those facts are generally not reflected in the pro-Palestinian tweets, but that's a topic to look at perhaps for another time. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have discovered some odd, never-seen-before wave-like structures moving through a dusty planet-forming disk surrounding a nearby star. The star is AU Microscopy, located 32 light-years away in the constellation Microscopium. Using the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile, the astronomers say that they saw what looked like ripples moving through water. They then pulled up some earlier images of the star that was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope in 2010 and 2011. At first, they couldn't find the mysterious ripples in the Hubble images, but after some reprocessing, they were not only able to recognize the ripples, but also see that they had changed over time. The astronomers say that this odd new celestial phenomenon could provide valuable insight into the formation of planets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The fight against ISIL in the Middle East has become very murky with the U.S.-led forces, Russia's involvement, the Assad regime, various rebel groups all involved in one place going over in Syria and Iraq. Joining me online is William Forsten, professor and author of Day of Wrath. Professor, what is your assessment of what's going on there in the fight against ISIL?
It's terrifying at this moment. Consider all the different forces that are involved and an area that geographically is not all that big. We have aircraft from a number of different sides that can, of course, do Mach plus speed, heavily armed. To me, it is a frightening scenario of an accidental war taking off and expanding.
What are you saying might happen?
We have some pilot who pushes the wrong button or gets a little bit too panicky at a particular moment, and suddenly we've shot down a Russian plane or they've shot down one of ours. Accidental wars, it's one of the standard ways a major war can get started, by accident. And is it being effective at all? Look at the amount of money that was spent by the United States to train, what, half a dozen fighters at $100 million apiece? We have to face the fact we're in a long-term conflict. And personally, I feel it's in the end, it's going to require boots on the ground.
Obama is very much opposed to that, however.
Yes, he is. And I wish he would wake up. I had to speak frankly on that. Recall a couple years back when he referred to ISIS, or some people now call ISIL, as a JV team. I do not consider an organization that is crucifying tens of thousands of people, murdering them, beheading them. And if you want to talk about a war on women, it is happening right now in that region. Women are the greatest victims of all, women and children, in this conflict.
What about the international community? What should they be doing?
A lot more than what's being done right now. There was a time when we would have stood up to what is essentially becoming a Holocaust, and it is not happening. I long for the day when we would see an organized international effort, but it simply is not happening.
What about Russia? Do you think they should pull out of the event?
I wish we could have a conversation with Putin and find out what is his hidden agenda regarding why he has placed so many assets into Syria fighting on that one particular side.
And you have a book. I've mentioned it, The Day of Wrath. Could you tell us just a little bit about it?
I wrote Day of Wrath a year and a half ago, and it was my concern about lack of security on America's borders combined with what happened in Beslan, Russia, September 1, 2004, the Beslan incident, BESLAN, where extremists seized a school and murdered over 300 children. We saw it happen in Pakistan in December. We've witnessed, what, over 1,000 women and children being taken prisoner in Nigeria and disappearing. What could happen if a small, well-trained team by ISIS was unleashed on two or three American schools? It would be far more profound and culturally shocking than what happened on 9/11.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
It's been my pleasure, and let's hope the situation gets straightened out.
Yes, certainly. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Coming up on International Edition, the ups and downs at the Democratic debate, and the story of a Pakistani teenager turned Nobel winner. The five Democratic candidates running for the White House in the United States have held their first debate, and our reporter Bill Gallo has been following it and joins us now. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
What do you find at the highs of the debate?
Well, it seems that Hillary Clinton was actually able to do quite well in this debate, according to many analysts. She was able to go on the offensive against Bernie Sanders, and that's what a lot of people had looked for, whether these two would go after each other. Bernie Sanders has tried to outflank her to the left on many positions, but he was able to highlight a few areas in which he seemed to be vulnerable, specifically on gun control and also on economic policies. And it seems that she may have actually landed a few blows. And also the reaction seems to be that she was just overall pretty calm and communicated very well, behaved like a front runner, and it was actually quite a good performance for her.
So she was a winner last night?
It seems that she was a winner.
Okay. What were the low points?
Well, like I said, the low point may have been Bernie Sanders on gun control. It seems to be an issue that he was quite vulnerable on, especially in the last few weeks. There's been some recent shootings, and his comments on gun control haven't exactly been in tune with what a lot of his liberal base may actually feel on this issue of gun control. Hillary Clinton criticized him for voting during his time in Congress against a law which would have required more background checks for potential gun owners, and he tried to hit back against that, but it was clearly a low point for him.
Well, you've been listening to analysts on this who've been following the debate. Overall, what is their sense about it?
Well, it's that Clinton did quite well, Bernie Sanders also did quite well, and that this remains a two-person race.
Okay, well, thank you very much for visiting with us.
Thanks so much.
Our national affairs correspondent, Jim Malone, was also following the Democratic debate and joins us. Welcome, Jim. A late night for you last night.
That's right, but interesting, a little more spirited debate than some of us expected.
Oh, really? Oh, well, we were interested in your thoughts on the big view. Will it make or break anyone in the Democratic contest?
I think it's helping to make Hillary Clinton once again a formidable front runner. I think some of the people in her campaign are breathing much easier the day after the debate. She gave a strong, polished performance. You know, go back to 2008, there were like 25 or so Democratic debates, and she did pretty well. So she's an experienced debater. Bernie Sanders, her main challenger, has an ability to whip up crowds with a couple of main themes, but she has a broader view, and I think that came into play during the debate. She was very strong on foreign policy issues, on the economy, but also Sanders may have handed her a gift on this whole email controversy when he said, enough with the emails, let's move on to the issues. Well, that nothing but helps Hillary Clinton. So on so many areas, I think she had a strong night. What does it all mean? I think it kind of resets that Democratic race. She'd been slipping, questions about her trustworthiness. Some of those things will still be there. It doesn't go away, and the Republicans will still have some ammunition for later on. But I think she's reset this race now. She's in charge.
Well, do you think this will make any of the other Democratic candidates, especially the weaker ones, start thinking about maybe not staying in the race?
Well, you could argue that, I suppose. Jim Webb, Lincoln Chafee. Martin O'Malley had perhaps the strongest night of those other three, the former Maryland governor. But, you know, Chafee and Webb aren't really doing much campaigning. They're not spending a lot of money. As long as they keep getting invited to the debates, they might hang in there. But it does argue for, you know, where are we going with this right now? And can Bernie Sanders expand his base beyond the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party? He was on the defensive a lot on economic policy, on guns. So it's a different now phase of the campaign for Bernie Sanders.
What about the Republicans? Will it change any of their campaigns, maybe give them some more ammunition in the race for the White House?
Well, certainly I think it's going to bolster the idea that there's a good chance that the Democrat they're going to be facing is Hillary Clinton. Now, that's something they've planned for all along. Clinton did bring up the Benghazi committee, though, during the debate. There's been some controversy of late about that. Charges the Republicans are targeting her politically. She's been able to play off some remarks by Kevin McCarthy. So I think the Republicans are still aiming for Hillary Clinton down the road. But they also realize she's going to be a tough opponent if and when it comes to that in the general election.
A couple of days ago, you and I were talking about Clinton being on Saturday Night Live and what a good job she did. She was amusing. But now I hear Donald Trump's going to be hosting Saturday Night Live. What is this all about?
Hey,
oh, we have a comedian president?
The Trump bandwagon rolls on. Donald Trump's had a great knack for knowing how to seize the public spotlight and keep it. And that's something he's shown throughout this Republican race so far. And I would expect it also to be a boon. You know, any politician who's willing to make fun of him or herself, it's a great asset with the public. And particularly Trump, who can come off as pompous at times, this could be a real opportunity to broaden his appeal in the sense where he could come off with a little bit of humility, and that never hurts a politician.
Thank you, Jim, for stopping by.
My pleasure.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
As of October 1st, 2015, smoking in cars while children are present has been banned in the United Kingdom. Other European countries may soon follow suit. Researchers at Newcastle University say the results of their new study show that smoke toxicity levels can rise dramatically inside a car in just a short time. Lead researcher Anil Nandeo.
The peak level a child exposed to. And we found that this peak could be up to 100 times higher than the safe recommended limits.
Namdeo adds that he considers that no level of smoke inside a car is safe for a child. Jo Harding is pregnant and pleased that her child won't have to breathe in secondhand smoke.
I don't want to be exposed to it as a pregnant person, but I don't want to expose to it as a non-pregnant person either.
Researchers say that the still developing respiratory systems and brains of children are especially susceptible to the effects of tobacco smoke. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Davis Guggenheim's documentary, He Named Me Malala, offers a probing look into the life of 18-year-old Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager who in 2012 was shot in the head by the Taliban for standing up for her rights to education in her hometown in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Guggenheim shows how since then, Malala has become a symbol, not as a victim of brutal violence, but as an advocate for girls' education throughout the world. VOA's Penelope Pulu has the story.
There is a moment when you have to choose whether to be silent or to stand up.
On October 9, 2012, Malala Yousafzai was shot in the head by the Taliban on her way home from school in Pakistan. Her crime? She believed in her right to education at a time when the Taliban was bombing schools in the Swat Valley. Her wounds were critical. But Malala Yousafzai survived stronger than ever.
They shot me on the left side of my head. They thought that the bullet would silence us. I am the same Malala.
1, 2, 3, go. To understand Malala's personality and inner power, Davis Guggenheim explores her family dynamics, especially her bond with her dad.
When she was very small, many friends used to come to our home. We used to talk about politics, we used to talk about the basic rights, and she used to sit with us.
When I was younger, I used to listen to him. Like, what is he saying, how he talks?
Davis Guggenheim says that Malala's life was almost prescribed from the moment her father, himself an activist, named her after a 19th century Afghan folk heroine.
She was inspired by the girl she was named after, the Malala of Mewand, that girl who spoke out for what she believed. And rallied the Afghan troops to defeat the British.
The film also shows that after Malala was shot, her father was devastated because he felt responsible for raising her with ideas that endangered her life. But Malala thinks otherwise.
My father only gave me the name Malala. He didn't make me Malala.
Still, the film raises the question, what formed Malala into the person she is today?
I chose this life.
Who would you have been if you were just an ordinary girl from the Swat Valley?
If I was an ordinary girl in Swat Valley, I'm still an ordinary girl. But if I had an ordinary father and an ordinary mother and a family, a conservative family, then I would have two children now.
After a slow and painful recovery, Malala made it her goal to rally for girls' education the world over. Guggenheim describes her as fearless.
Malala, you know, speaks to world leaders. We were in Nigeria when the girls had been kidnapped for a long period of time, and she insisted to sit down with President Goodluck Jonathan and said, "What are you doing about these girls? It's your job to get them released." She met President Obama and asked him about drone strikes.
Nobel Peace Prize is to be awarded to Malala Yousafzai.
That fearlessness and her message brought her the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014.
She has something to teach the world, not just because she was a girl who was shot on the school bus, not just because of her advocacy work, but because she has a very, very deep soul. She's a very spiritual person, and I think she has a strong voice that speaks to a lot of people who are voiceless.
I tell my story not because it is unique. It is the story of many girls. We realize the importance of light when we see darkness, the importance of our voice when we are silenced. Let us pick up our books and our pens. They are our most powerful weapons.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States believes that the rights to freedom of expression and assembly are rights that all people should enjoy, online and offline. Americans and people around the world, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power, have a tremendous amount to gain from a free and open internet, from the broader sharing of information and ideas to more markets for businesses to a more transparent and accountable government. The internet plays a critical role in supporting democratic activity of non-governmental organizations and individuals. During a recent UN General Assembly event on internet freedom, Ambassador Power noted that there is significant correlation between governments that use the internet to repress their own citizens and NGOs and those same governments using the internet to launch cyber attacks on other countries and to hack the websites of foreign nationals and companies. During that event, in recognition of the importance a free internet plays in safeguarding human rights, Ambassador Power announced a new initiative called LIFT, Leading Internet Freedom Technology Initiative. The goal is for LIFT to foster innovative next-generation technologies to circumvent internet censorship. The U.S. is launching LIFT with a $10 million investment this year, raising its annual support for internet freedom to $33 million. The potential impact of these new technologies really can be profound, said Ambassador Power. They have the potential to make the internet inherently more resistant to control. These new technologies could help millions of users gain access to the global internet free of censorship. They complement the United States' support of secure communication technologies, as well as its broader support for civil society development and the digital and physical safety of human rights defenders. The United States cannot undertake this task alone. More governments should consider joining the Freedom Online Coalition and the Open Government Partnership. In addition, technology companies should embrace the UN guiding principles on business and human rights. These companies are also uniquely positioned to leverage their own technological innovation in order to preserve the free and open internet. It's important to remember that history is on the side of freedom. Every previous effort to destroy or curb new technologies enhancing freedom of speech, said Ambassador Power, have eventually failed. So even as repressive governments are pouring resources into trying to control the internet, the odds and time favor freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.